Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 16, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss Microsoft versus Baker, the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome back return guest to Teleforum, Ted H. Frank. He's the Senior Attorney and Director of the Center for Class Action Fairness at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's going to give us opening remarks, including some background on the case of perhaps 15 to 20 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Ted Frank, the floor is yours.
Thanks. Well, this is a case involving the intersection of class action, civil procedure, and appellate jurisdiction. So very exciting for me, and I'm sure will motivate you if you're listening this on a treadmill weeks after the call is recorded. The underlying case was Baker versus Microsoft, a putative class action brought in federal court alleging defects in the manufacture of Xbox 360s and the way they handled the CDs that were used to provide software and like that. The case, though, is all about procedural tactics, and I think it's important to just sort of step back and look at the background of this. As you know, in a class action, the case is often not litigated so much on the merits as on the procedural question of whether the case can be certified as a class. If a case can be certified as a class and can proceed as a class action with hundreds of thousands or millions of class members, the case will often settle well before trial, given the risks to the defendant of proceeding on a class-wide basis. And similarly, if the case cannot be certified as a class, it's uneconomic for the plaintiffs to proceed on what's a claim for a few dollars, or here maybe a few hundred dollars. So there's always that litigation over the class certification. And the question is, if the class isn't certified, well, what are your appellate rights? And in the 1970s, plaintiffs would lose their class certification motion and then say, well, this is an interlocutory decision, technically, but you should treat it as a final decision under 28 U.S.C. 1291, which provides for appellate jurisdiction, but only for final decisions, not for interlocutory decisions, on the theory that when the court denies class certification, it's the death knell of the litigation, and that makes it final. In 1978, the Supreme Court rejected this concept in Coopers and Librand versus Livesay, and said the death knell doctrine is no good. 1291 means what it says. You need a final decision. No interlocutory appeals. This seemed to be a little harsh, and they eventually amended the federal rules, Rule 23F, in 1998, and that permitted a permissive interlocutory appeal of class certification decisions. If a class certification decision went against you, you could take it up to the appellate court. The appellate court could decide whether or not they wanted to hear it. And as class action jurisprudence has matured, fewer and fewer of these cases are getting heard on 23F appeals, and they only take about 20% of those cases now. So you still have what happens to the 80% of the cases that don't get heard. Do you just accept the certification decision, or do you try to figure out a way to get yourself into the appellate courts? And plaintiffs had come up with this interesting tactic. They lose the class certification motion, and then they say, well, we hereby voluntarily dismiss our claims with prejudice, with the reservation of rights that we want to still pursue the class action. and then purport to appeal their own voluntary dismissal and the own as an adverse judgment for review of the class certification issue. Defendants, of course, weren't having this. They would say, wait a second, this isn't a final judgment. You're not really dismissing your case because you're purporting to leave it open whether you can come back and litigate it, so then it's not 1291. Or if you're really saying that it is a final judgment, then you don't have a case or controversy anymore. You're the named plaintiffs, and you don't have Article III standing because you've agreed to voluntarily dismiss your claims, and there's no longer a case or controversy between you and the defendant. And in Baker versus Microsoft, Microsoft made all of those arguments, and the Ninth Circuit just sort of shrugged its shoulders and said, no, we're okay with this. We're going to call it a final judgment, and we're going to say there's Article III standing because there's still a dispute over the class certification question. They permitted the appeal to go forward. They granted class certification, and Microsoft appeals or seeks certiorari in the Supreme Court. And they get this in early 2016, or perhaps it was late 2015, not sure the exact date. But they get it, and that timing is interesting because shortly after cert was granted, Justice Scalia dies. And the court responds by delaying argument indefinitely. And there was a lot of speculation that this was one of those closely divided class action cases where Scalia was asserting his opposition to abuse of class actions, and that with his death it would be a 4-4 issue. And though the court did delay argument well into October term 2016, in fact, until March, there were still an 8 justice panel at that time, and there was a lot of speculation that this would be an evenly decided case and that there would still be the issue unresolved. Most courts don't permit these sorts of appeals. The Ninth Circuit did. And it turned out not to be a close case at all. After argument, where the court was pretty clearly skeptical of the respondent's case, they unanimously reject the strategy of appealing these sorts of class certification denials, but they do it for different reasons. The five-justice majority decision, led by Ginsburg and the liberal wing of the court plus Kennedy, says this is a final judgment. Excuse me, they say there's no appellate jurisdiction under Section 1291 because it's not a final judgment. This is just an attempt to try to get death knell all over again. And therefore, because we're resolving it under 1291, we don't need to reach the constitutional question. And the concern that the court raised was you have Rule 23F there, and this is an attempt to completely undo it, that you have this balance permitting appellate courts to decide whether or not they want to take these appeals, and you're trying to get the interlocutory appeal anyway by claiming it's a final judgment, and you can't do that. And they noted the sort of asymmetry of this because if they did permit it to go forward, then plaintiffs would be able to basically get the interlocutory review of class certification by agreeing to these voluntary dismissals that weren't really voluntary dismissals and then getting appellate rights under 1291, but defendants would never have that opportunity or would not have that opportunity without taking tremendous risks to themselves. The other three justices also agreed that the plaintiffs couldn't do this, they felt that it was a final decision under 1291. After all, there was a dismissal and there was nothing left of the case. That did make it a final decision, but they said that there was no Article III standing because once the parties agree to voluntarily dismiss the case, they're no longer adverse to the defendants. There's nothing to resolve between the plaintiffs and the defendants. That's between the court. While the plaintiffs may argue that there's a case or controversy over the class allegation, Justice Thomas wrote, quote, class allegations, without an underlying individual claim do not give rise to a case or controversy. Those allegations are simply the means of invoking a procedural mechanism that enables the plaintiff to litigate his individual claims on behalf of a class. And that standing question is obviously very important in future litigation. To what extent does a class representative need standing? What extent can you divest a class representative of standing by mooting their individual claim? And to what extent can you certify a class where individual class members in the class may not have standing under Article 3? All of these questions remain to be taken and seen, and there are people out there saying that this four-page concurrence provides some hints on those questions. What does all this mean? Well, this particular tactic for plaintiffs will disappear, but never fear, they have other tactics. Just because you lose class certification in one case, they still have options. They can bring class actions because after the Bayer decision of the Supreme Court in the last few years, plaintiffs can always bring a new class action in a new jurisdiction and seek class certification there, because any new class representative isn't bound by the class certification decision of a different district court. So that sort of heads I win, tails don't count options are still out there, though that's obviously slightly more expensive for plaintiffs, and is not available to them if, for example, these class actions are consolidated in a multi-district litigation. On Twitter, plaintiff's lawyer Jay Edelson suggested that the plaintiffs should have just tried their case for a few $100 and won or lost, and then appealed the lack of class certification. But again, it's not clear that they would have standing to do that if they won the case. If they've won the case and they've gotten their damages, is there still a case or controversy over the remaining class certification issues? And Justice Thomas would suggest that there isn't. So that's a risky strategy, and trials are expensive, and we may not see anybody try that, but perhaps Edelson PC will do that one day. And there's legislation pending, H.R. 985, which passed the House and is pending in the Senate, though has yet to be marked up or in any hearings or any indication from the Senate Judiciary Committee that they're interested in it. But part of that legislation would make 23F appeals appeals as of right, interlocutory appeals as of right, without the permissive indication, and that would benefit both plaintiffs or defendants on the decision of class certification. So that's where things stand, and I look forward to people's questions.
Terrific. Thank you so much for that summary. Let's go right to the audience with questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see who rings in, let me remind our audience about our telephone conference call scheduled next week. We've reserved Monday and Tuesday for Supreme Court decisions that might be emerging on Monday and Tuesday, but we do have calls already scheduled for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The bottom line, I guess, for our listeners is to check in with our website and monitor your emails for other calls that will be scheduled early next week. Again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me start things off while we wait to see if the audience has questions. And that's, would you want to speculate or take a stab at why the court would hold this case for so long? You mentioned in your opening remarks that cert was granted some time ago, and this was among that small number of cases that were the argument date was delayed. Most folks speculated while waiting for a ninth justice. It was argued with eight, and then turns out to be unanimous. Any insights there?
Well, I would imagine if we're going to do the Kremlinology on this, that Scalia was a motivating vote for certiorari, and the questions of Article 3 standing for class plaintiffs, I think, is one that closely divides the court and could eventually be a 5-4 decision down the line. And I think the court was hoping that they wouldn't have to risk a 4-4 decision on this, and that they were hoping to get a ninth justice, and then eventually just decided that things were going too slowly in terms of the confirmation, and they would just go ahead and hear it. Or maybe they recognized that there is a way to resolve this without having to reach the knottier Article 3 or the more controversial Article 3 question once they saw the briefs and the amicus. But all of this, of course, is speculation. We'll have to wait for a justice's papers to be released down the line to see what really happened. So mark your calendars for 2036 or whatever, and we can learn it then. Right, only three justices ruled on the Article 3 question, and the other five expressly avoided it by deciding it on stretching 1291 to sort of say that this wasn't a final judgment. And that's certainly colorable because of the sort of weaselly dismissal, saying we're only dismissing it if we can't get class certification on appeal.
Right. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We don't have any questions from the audience yet, so I've got a couple more. Let me ask a two-part question. One, the net result here, does this tip things in favor of defendants, class defendants, and if so, how much? And second, and somewhat related, I suppose, are there other pending cases that you're aware of that this is going to have an effect on?
Well, taking the second part first, there were a variety of cases pending in the Ninth Circuit, which of course has a 2-year lead time between appeals and decisions, where it is exactly this fact pattern. The plaintiffs lose the class certification motion and voluntarily dismiss their claims, seeking the interlocutory review of the class certification. And now all of those appeals get resolved. The Ninth Circuit doesn't get to decide the class certification issues on those. So for that handful of cases where the plaintiffs have engaged in that tactic, and there was a pharmaceutical case, and there are a handful of others, I think. At least those where the defendants have preserved this issue. Though I guess since a court has an obligation to review appellate jurisdiction, even if they haven't preserved the issue, they still get to raise the Microsoft v. Baker decision. Those individual cases get resolved. And that, I think, helps answer your first question. It, to the extent that plaintiffs could bring cases within the Ninth Circuit and get the Ninth Circuit expansive reading of appellate jurisdiction on class certification review, that was a sort of finger on the scales of how plaintiffs could prevail in class action cases, and that they could get two bites at the apple on the class certification decision, while defendants would only get one bite at the apple, or I guess 3-2 if you include the permissive 23F shot at review. And so that was a slight advantage to plaintiffs that is no longer available, though, as the Bayer decision holds, plaintiffs have other ways of getting multiple bites at the apple if there isn't a multi-district litigation consolidation.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left. You mentioned in your opening remarks that this ruling would not preclude a new class action being filed with different named plaintiffs. provided there hadn't been any consolidation, any MDL, I suppose, I think you mentioned. I'm curious about that. I mean, and whether or not the same law firm or lawyers could do this, not necessarily endlessly, but repeatedly. And does it ever get to a point where enough is enough under that scenario?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting question. If a class action is a procedural device, then the only people bound by the original decision are the individual plaintiffs, not the law firms, not others. And certainly, for example, the Seventh Circuit was very harsh about this and would slap down successive class actions or even enjoin them. There was a case called Thorogood versus Sears where Posner was very harsh of the tactic of bringing multiple class actions. But the Supreme Court, as is its wont, and it's been very consistent about this sort of ruling, whether it benefits plaintiffs or defendants, they hold that class actions are purely procedural joinder devices and don't have substantive implications beyond that. So if you lose your class certification motion in the Northern District of Illinois, go ahead to the Eastern District of Tennessee or the Southern District of California and bring your class certification motion there, because the only people bound by it are the individual plaintiffs who brought the first class certification motion. And if you have a real class with millions of people, and enough of them think that they're injured, that you can keep doing this, you can play that Russian roulette game of heads I win and tails I'll do it again with a new individual plaintiff. We've seen this happen in a number of cases since Bayer has been decided.
You mentioned also in the concurrence some hints about other issues. I wonder if you want to say a little bit more about those.
Well, there's the interesting question of whether defendants can sort of pick off a class action. So the plaintiff brings their lawsuit and says, I want to bring a class action. I've been injured by $8, and so have these other 2 million people. Can the defendants just say, well, here's a check for your $8, and now your claim is moot, and now you can't bring your class action? And courts split on this, whether that does moot the case and the proceedings. One suggestion is that it doesn't, so long as a class certification motion is pending, and others say it doesn't because otherwise you could keep picking off lead plaintiffs forever, and others say that does end the case. So that controversy is still pending. There was a very heated 5-4 decision by Scalia with respect to wage and hour laws, which aren't quite Rule 23, with a, I thought, was a pretty persuasive Kagan dissent on why the Scalia majority opinion was wrong. But in that particular case, they did say that it did moot the case to have made the offer, which would seem to have implications for Rule 23, but we don't know how Gorsuch would come out on that, and there's the intermediate position that the Seventh Circuit takes, which is a pending class certification motion means that it's not moot. But if you take the Thomas language seriously, it suggests that the Seventh Circuit is wrong about that. So that could really tilt the playing field for defendants if that really is the case.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. You brought up Justice Gorsuch, and I know you follow the court more generally, so let me expand the discussion here a little bit, and feel free to dodge this question because I think it might require a lot of speculation on your part. But when Justice Gorsuch was confirmed, there was a lot of discussion as to whether or not he would participate in decisions for cases he hadn't sat for cases he hadn't heard the oral argument for. This, I guess, is in that category. He's on the court at the time the decision's rendered. He did not participate in oral argument. He didn't participate in the decision either. Does that say anything about any of the other like cases with decisions still pending?
I think the answer is that it probably doesn't matter. He's not going to – it sounds like he's not going to insert himself in the cases that he hasn't heard. But if the court comes down 4-4, they can all eight agree, let's rehear the case with Justice Gorsuch and thereby get him in the loop on those cases. And please re-argue it. In the first week of October, and we'll decide it with Justice Gorsuch then.
I don't know
how many of those 4-4 cases are out there, and certainly the court has been so sparing with its certiorari grants lately that there might not be very many.
And if you know, I mean, what does that look like? Does that mean that they actually publish a 4-4 decision, and then does
well,
it really
no,
take all eight justices? I mean, but so we wouldn't know there was a 4-4 decision. They would just be order for re-argument.
You could back into the fact that that there must have been a 4-4 decision by the fact that they issued that order and asked for the re-argument. Because there would be no reason to do it if it was 6-2 or 5-3.
Right. And does it take eight to ask for re-argument, or just four, or just
no,
the chief?
I think it would take a majority, all five, because otherwise you could have, if it was anything less than a majority, then the minority could always postpone a decision indefinitely. But generally, if it's a 4-4 decision, the result comes down pretty quickly. We affirm by an equally divided court. So the only scenario where this could happen is if it was 5-3 in conference and a justice changes his or her mind. We're talking a pretty rare situation, and the court was already postponing cases where it thought it might come down 4-4.
Right. We do have a question from our audience, so let's turn to our first caller now.
Hi, this is Wesley Hungbui, student member. Earlier in your statement, you mentioned some possible input from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Are there any upcoming pieces of legislation that you think could impact the class action process? Thank you.
Well, absolutely. The Fairness and Class Action Litigation Act, which was H.R. 985 and has been passed by the House and is pending in the Senate, has a number of sweeping changes about class action certification, appellate jurisdiction over class certification decisions, and attorney's fees. And it's a very controversial bill. There was a very good teleforum on this with Andrew Grossman that I recommend on the Federalist Society website. And if the Senate decides to take it up, in its current form, I think it's pretty hard to imagine it getting the 60 votes to get past cloture, but that bill is out there and would have a pretty dramatic effect certainly a dramatic effect on class action litigation, whether it actually changes the balance or whether courts sort of play with the language in the statute to sort of keep things where they are is a different question.
Thank you.
To follow up on your point there, Ted Frank, virtually every teleforum conference call is recorded and then posted on the Federalist Society's website under Practice Group Podcast. So if you go to the Federal Society's website, that's where you can find the teleforum that that Ted Frank just alluded to with Andrew Grossman of the Baker Hostetler firm. There's also a related teleforum by Victor Schwartz of the Shook Hardy Bacon Law Firm here in Washington, where he talked about that proposed legislation and even some other legislation pending on the Hill. Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now's the time to ask. Okay, I don't see a final question, or we've had our final question. Ted Frank, do you want to take a minute or two to express a final thought here?
Go team. I don't know.
Well, let me ask you the final question, then, and this might give you a chance to wrap up. Are there any more class action cases pending in this term, or any significant class action cases that have been granted for the fall 2017 term?
It's possible, but I just don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
Fair enough.
Up to speed on it.
Well, that's sort of beyond the scope of this call. So with that, let me thank our guest, Ted Frank. This has been a very helpful explanation. And a reminder, thanks to our audience as well for dialing in. And a reminder to our audience to check in with the website and monitor your emails for our next scheduled teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.